The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, so I'm Claudette Gardell, and I'm the instructor of this course, and I've been asked to do the second immunology lecture because Professor Jax is out of town. So he talked to you on Friday, and he introduced the topic of immunology, and he talked about the cells that one finds in the blood, and these are the cells that are important for immunology. They're responsible for the immune response. And he mentioned, I believe he mentioned mast cells and macrophages and neutrophils and plasma cells and B cells and T cells. And those are really the main players of immunology. He also, He also talked to you about the incredible diversity, incredible, tremendous repertoire of antibodies that we have that recognize variable, based on their variable regions, they can recognize a whole slew of antigens, okay? And this is like, this is a graphic depiction of an antibody. This is a heterodimer. Tetramer, and this diversity is a result of gene rearrangement in the variable region of the antibody chains. And so you heard VDJ recombination. So this is at the level of DNA recombination. Similar to the gene rearrangement that occurs in B cells that results in the diversity of antibodies, T cells also have rearrangement for their variable region of their T cell receptors. So we have a population of B cells and T cells that can recognize a wide array of foreign antigens. Okay, so this is immunology. This is a topic that makes grown scientists run away, and partly it is because there are so many terms and so much jargon, and it just seems so confusing to get it all straight. And it is. There's a lot of jargon. So my goal in this lecture is to try and make you understand conceptually what's going on, okay? And I don't have handouts, but I promise I will put this on. Now, this isn't very helpful, but I will put this PowerPoint presentation on the web, and I have, like, try to elucidate the main concepts of immunology, which is so cool. It is like such a cool topic, okay? So we're going to get through this. Okay, so what is immunology? It's how we fight infections. And what causes infections? Pathogens. So let's have a look and see what we're up against. This is what we're fighting, okay? There's parasites and fungi and bacteria and viruses, and they cause a whole slew of diseases. You've heard of some of them, right? Smallpox we heard of, influenza. We're going to study AIDS. We talked about polio a little bit. We had cholera, perhaps, and tetanus we talked about. And what must every pathogen do to cause disease? They must enter you. They want to live on you. They want to grow on you. You are their food source. So they want to enter you. They want to evade the immune system, which we're about to learn about. They want to colonize and multiply and grow. And then they want to spread to other hosts. That's all they want. Whether you get hurt in the process, they don't care. They can cause disease three different ways. Pathogens have basically three main strategies to cause disease. They can cause disease from an extracellular point of view. And so here I've drawn some, could you keep it down? Some epithelial cells. These little spots here are nuclei. The pink represents damage. So these pathogens can cause damage without being in close proximity to the cell. This is usually the result of secreting a toxin. And this is this occurs with tetanus, anthrax, gangrene. Other pathogens have to be right up close to the cell surface to cause disease. And this is true of the causative agent of cholera. So they get up close, and then they can cause damage. And then there are others that are intracellular. They actually get within the cell. And this is true of many bacterial pathogens like chlamydia and tuberculosis, the causative agents of tuberculosis. And it's true of every single virus. Okay. So we have developed strategies to deal with this. And this strategy goes under the main umbrella called the immune response. And the immune response can be divided into two main parts: innate or nonspecific, and acquired, and adaptive and specific. Okay. So this slide is actually my summary slide. And it's going to blow you away a little bit, but by the end of the talk, you're going to understand it, okay? So we're going to go through it really quickly. You're going to, like, glaze over, and then we're going to go through it. Slow. Oops. What happened? Tom? Okay. Oh, that was good. Okay, so the innate response is composed of things that we have all the time, natural barriers to the disease. They're always present. It's a quick response, and it doesn't result in anything long-lived. The acquired or adaptive response takes longer, and it's divided into two kinds: humoral, and the other kind is cell-mediated, or sometimes it's called cellular, and sometimes it's called cell-based. This is why immunology is so confusing. Professor Jax used the word cell-based. And the main players of these are going to be shown here. So humoral has macrophages, helper T-cells, and B-cells. The main player of the cell-based is killer T-cells. This is the pathway that they work. You're going to learn about this in detail. A lysozyme breaks up the antigen into epitopes. It's presented on MHC2 molecules. In the case of cell-based, it's a proteasome that breaks it up into epitopes presented on MHC1 molecules. And it's presented to the helper T-cell by Leibniz receptor, which is associated with CD4, or to the killer T-cell, which has a T-cell receptor with an accessory protein called CD8. The end result of the humoral response, antibodies and memory B-cells. The end result of the cell-based response, memory T-cells. That's it. Okay, so that's what you're going to know by the end of the lecture. Here's the immune response. Here's the innate. We're going to discuss the innate. This is an exploded diagram of a human, sort of. Now, I talked about pathogens, and I talked about bacteria being pathogens, but not all bacteria are pathogens. In fact, we are colonized by bacteria. We are colonized by microbes. In fact, they outnumber us. There's 10 to the 13 cells that we have, and there's 10 to the 14 bacteria. They live on our skin. They live in our large intestine. And this is a good thing, okay, because they're commensals, and they take up space to prevent real professional pathogens from honing in on that space. So commensals are beneficial. Plus, we have things called skin. Skin is a good barrier. It prevents us from looking like a piece of meat. You know, it's tough, it's thick, it's salty, it has a low pH, it's not exactly 37 degrees, it's a little bit cooler. Pathogens like to be at 37 degrees, has fatty acids, which is sort of antimicrobial. Skin is good. Yet some pathogens have evolved systems to get through the skin. For instance, malaria gets in on a mosquito bite. Yersinia pestis, the causative agent of bubonic plague, gets in on a flea bite. Okay, so some can get through the skin, and then of course there's cuts. The eye is mostly sterile due to lysozyme, which is an enzyme that breaks down bacterial cell walls. Your respiratory tract is surprisingly sterile, considering there's 500 to 1,000 microbes per cubic meter of air. And as you're sitting here at rest in 10 to 50, breathing in about 6 liters a minute, that translates to about 10,000 microbes a day. And why is it? But I just told you that your respiratory tract is relatively sterile, and that's because it's lined with mucus, which traps the microbes, and the cells along the respiratory tract have these little cilia that look like little hair-like projectiles, and they're beating up. They're constantly beating up the microbes, and they get to the back of your throat, and you swallow them, okay? So you swallow them, and then the stomach, sterile environment because of the low pH, there is some microbes that can live in the stomach, and they cause ulcers. Small intestine, is that sterile or not? Nobody knows. It's very sterile. It's a hostile environment. It's full of bile. If you can live there, like Vibrio cholera, you'll be causing disease. The large intestine, is that sterile? No. There's so many bacteria in the large intestine that per gram of feces, there's 10 to the 11th bacteria. That's a one with 11 zeros after it. So it's a lot of bacteria, and this is a good thing. E. coli secretes a little vitamin K for us, and there are commensals. The bladder should be sterile, the kidney should be sterile, and the flushing action of urine is constantly pushing down microbes that might be wanting to infect us. Okay, within the blood, there's also some innate components. One of them is the complement system. The complement system is a series of serum proteins that can recognize non-specifically many different bacterial pathogens. And they come, and it's an enzymatic cascade, and they land on the surface of the bacteria, and then they can either recruit other members of the immune system, or they can actually physically drill a hole in the bacterium and kill it, like a little oil rig. And then there's macrophages, which I like to abbreviate this way, macrophage. Macrophages are white blood cells that engulf, they swallow, they phagocytize. Phago means to eat, macro means a lot. They eat a lot, and they eat non-specifically. They just swallow and take things away non-specifically. There's also interferons is a component of the innate response. And that's interesting in that when a cell is infected with the virus, sometimes it will secrete, and it knows it's infected. Sometimes it knows it's infected, and sometimes it has the ability to secrete interferon, and there are other cells that have receptors for interferon, and when it's through a signal transduction mediated pathway, they go into a virus, an antivirus state, and they stop making protein, and they start cutting away RNAs. And so actually some of the bad feelings that we have when we have flu is not really the flu virus. It's the result of interferons being globally secreted in our body and our cells sort of shutting down. Okay. So here's the inflammatory response, okay? And here we have a splinter. This is a piece of wood coming in, and look. Oh, look. It's coated with little bacteria, okay? And actually, this experiment was done by Meshnikov many, many years ago, where he took a splinter and he put it into a starfish leg, one of those little projectiles of the starfish. And he looked, and he saw these cells trying to engulf the wood. And that turned out to be the macrophage, okay? So he was actually the first person who discovered the macrophage. So here we see the splinter penetrating the dermis, and these cells here are called mast cells, and they're full of vesicles that secrete histamines. And the histamines cause the blood vessel that's underlying to become more permeable such that the macrophages and neutrophils, phagocytes, can come to the area and swallow the bacteria. So this is histamine. These are the macrophages that are coming and swallowing. And also, you can see these little red dots are complement. Those are the serum proteins that will come and land nonspecifically on bacteria and lyse them. And the macrophages will also secrete something we call cytokines. Cytokines are signaling molecules that immune cells use. And there's a whole array of cytokines, and they have a whole different variety of effects. Some cytokines have global effects upon us. They cause us to have fever and not feel too well. Okay, so after the infection, you notice the macrophages swallowing a dead infected cell. They clean up, and then these cells will grow and will be repaired. So this is the inflammatory response. It's the hallmark is redness and swelling and heat. And so now let's discuss the acquired response. The acquired takes longer. There was the humoral cell mediated. The end result of the humoral response are antibodies and memory B cells. The end response of cell-mediated or killer T cell. We're going to talk about the humoral response right now, and I'm going to give you an example of a disease. This is Vibrio cholera. It's a bacterium that causes cholera. There are some places in the world where people get it, cholera, and this person is suffering, and the doctor has squeezed her skin, and you can still see that the skin is still upright because she's severely dehydrated. The disease is marked by severe diarrhea that can lead to death within hours. And they measure, what they do to treat cholera is they measure the amount of diarrhea that happens, and that is the exact amount that they replace in fluids. The life cycle of the bacterium is shown here. You ingest contaminated food or water. The bacterium get through the low pH of the stomach. They swim through the mucus gel overlying the small intestine epithelial cells, at which point they adhere, and they start to elaborate cholera toxin and other factors that allow them to colonize and multiply. It is the action of cholera toxin which causes the severe diarrhea, and it releases the vibrios into the environment, and the cycle continues. And some of you had in your signal transduction the action of cholera toxin where it like turns on the alpha protein in the intestinal cell, causing high levels of cyclic AMP, which results in chloride ions and salt followed by water going into the lumen of the small intestine. A person can die in as little as 8 hours due to the result, the action of the toxin, and yet it's absolutely treatable with oral hydration, and yet still 50,000 people die each year because it can take up to 40 liters of liquids to restore hydration. And sometimes it takes place in areas where there's not water, or for some reason small babies can't take in the water. Without treatment, 70% will die. With treatment, less than 1% will die. Now, there are some places in the world where cholera is endemic. People get it, and they get treated with oral rehydration. And once you get it, you don't get it again. You will have developed long-lived immunity to cholera. And this long-lived immunity is a result of the humoral response. So the next slide will show you the two key members, actually three key members of the humoral response dealing with a pathogen. So here we have a macrophage. Here we have a B cell. And look, this little red dot could be a pathogen, it could be an antigen, and it's about to be engulfed by the macrophage, and it's about to be recognized on the surface. It's about to be recognized on the by the variable region of the antibody, which is on the surface of this B cell. This is the B cell, this is the macrophage. Okay, so the macrophage swallows it, and it goes into an endosome. It endocytoses it, or phagocytosis. It could be a phagosome or an endosome, it's called. The B cell does exactly the same thing. It brings it in on the antibody, and so it's also in an endosome or phagosome. And see this little circle here? That's a lysosome. Do you remember lysosome? We had them early. This is not lysozyme, which is the enzyme that's in the tears that break down cell walls. No, this is an organelle that's found in cells, and it's full of degradative enzymes, proteases, nucleases, lipases, and it fuses with the phagosome and chews it up into little itty bitty pieces. And these little itty-bitty pieces are loaded onto these molecules called MHC class II molecules. And they display little 8 or 9 amino acid snippets of what was just chewed up. The only two cells in the body that make MHC2 molecules are the macrophages and the B cells. And who are they displaying it to? Well, there's this third cell right here. It's the helper T cell. And the helper T cell recognizes the MHC2 class molecule in conjunction with the epitope by virtue of its T cell receptor. Okay. Here's some helper T cells. Here's one, either a macrophage or a B cell. This sort of looks like a B cell. It's an antigen-presenting cell, of which there are only two kinds, B cells and macrophages, and they have MHC class II. Okay, here's another way of looking at it. Pathogen engulfed. There's the phagosome or endosome. Looks like the lysosome is already fused. It's broken up into little fragments. Peptide fragments are called epitopes. They're loaded onto MHC class II molecules, presented to the helper T cell. And now look, here's the T cell receptor. It has an accessory protein. The helper T cell receptor's accessory protein is called CD4. Okay, so now remember the helper T cell is going to bind to the macrophage, and it's going to only if it recognizes the epitope in conjunction with MHC2. And should that happen, the macrophage sends out some cytokines, special cytokines that causes the helper T cell to also send out cytokines to itself and causes it to clonally expand. Okay, so many more of these helper T cells are around. So here we go. It's found the macrophage. It becomes activated. It becomes in an activated state. It clonally expands, but it still remains in a sort of activated state. And should it encounter a B cell that has swallowed the exact same antigen or pathogen and is displaying the exact same epitope, then it causes the B cell to do something through the action of cytokines. So here it's finding the B cell. It has the exact same epitope, and it sends these cytokines, and it causes the B cell to clonally expand into memory B cells and also to differentiate into plasma B cells that are now secreting the antibody that originally recognize that the surface of the bacterium or the antigen, and now these are now being secreted into the blood or wherever they are. Okay, here it is again. Helper T cell recognizes the B cell, sends a signal, clonal expansion. The ones where the antibodies remain on the surface are called memory cell. Now they're in greater abundance. Some of them differentiate into these cells that have lots of endoplasmic reticulum because they're synthesizing a secreted protein. Now it's secreted, and it's called antibody. So we've got all this secreted antibody and all these memory T cells, B cells. And this is the reason why the secondary response is greater. Okay, so the first time you encounter a pathogen or an antigen, it takes a while. And it's not as great, the magnitude of antibodies. But the second time, because we have all those extra memory cells around, it's much quicker, and it's also a greater magnitude. Now, if some of you are observing that there's these things called IgM and IgG, well, this refers to different classes of antibodies. And there are different classes. IgM are the ones that are sort of on the surface of the B cells. They're sort of still tethered at some point. And then as they become plasma cells, they secrete, they actually have secreted antibodies. And there are different classes depending upon what fluids the antibodies will be found in. For instance, IgG is the predominant antibody found in the blood. IgA is found in some mucuses and tears and mother's milk. So babies don't have any immune system, but if they're nursed, they get the IgA from their mother, and actually it goes into their small intestine and just goes right across into their bloodstream. So it actually helps them because it takes babies a while to develop antibody-making systems. IgE is an antibody that has been implicated in allergic responses. Do you remember the mast cell that have those ready pockets of histamine ready to like secrete out and cause like an array of effects? Well, they also have receptors for IgE. And so some of us have allergies, right? And when we have allergies, we develop IgE to ragweed or cat dander. And as a result, if we're exposed to this antigen, we can have this reaction involving IgE and mast cells, resulting in histamine release. And if it's very bad, then it can actually result in anaphylactic shock. Okay, so antibodies, you know. We have a whole production of antibodies made, but how do they actually fight disease? What do they do? You know, so we've got them floating in our blood. How do they rid ourselves of the infection? Well, they do it three ways. Okay, remember Vibrio cholera? It wants to get to the intestinal epithelium to cause disease. Here's a bacterium here. Here are antibodies that are specific to the surface of Vibrio cholera, this bacterium here. It is coated with this furriness of antibodies. Can it touch the tissue? No, it can't. It is sterically hindered from getting to its surface. And this would be true of a toxin, too. If a toxin, a protein toxin, or a toxin is coated with antibodies, it can't get to a receptor and cause ill effects. Okay, so now we've got these antigens and bacteria, and they're coated with antibodies. Opsonization. This is derived from a Greek word which means seasoning on food, like salt and pepper. So here's a pathogen. It's coated with antibodies. In comes the macrophage and swallows it up. Now, the macrophage would devour this thing anywhere without the antibodies. But it might be slower. It might be a little pokey. It's like seasoning on food. When you have antibodies on it, it's going to do it voraciously. And why is that? It's because the variable region binds to the bacterium or the pathogen or the antigen. What's sticking out is the constant region of the antibody. No matter what's on the variable region, the constant region is the same. So the macrophages have receptors that recognize this constant region, and they zip it up and they swallow it. Likewise, antibody triggers the complement system. So although the complement system might come in slowly, when it sees antibodies bound to a bacterium, it comes in and it does its little oil drill thing instantly. Okay, so that's how antibodies prevent disease. Here's a picture of the macrophage with its receptors. This end of the molecule of the antibody is called Fc, so the receptor is called the Fc receptor, and it just coats it and brings it in, ingests it, and... Okay, so we've got antibodies as a result of the humoral response. Would they be effective in preventing a toxin from binding to a surface if we had antibodies against that toxin? You bet. It's very good for pathogens that cause extracellular disease from an outside surface, from away from the cell. It's very good for toxins. Extremely good. What about preventing cholera again? Can it prevent a pathogen from binding to a surface, an adherent bacteria? Yes, we just showed you it did. Steric hindrance. But what about the case of viruses or other things that are intracellular that cause disease from within? Would antibodies be effective there? Only if they were caught before they got in. But once they're in, They're protected from macrophages. They're protected from antibodies. They're in a nice, warm, nutrient-rich environment. They're looking pretty good. And many professional pathogens have opted for this tack. So what we've done is we've developed the other wing of the immune system called cell-mediated to deal with intracellular pathogens. And these are the stars of the cell-mediated or cell-based or cellular system, and they're called killer T cells, and they are the coolest cell in your body. They're like the Terminator, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator. And so they go around, and they, like, will protect us. So let's show you this. Okay, this thing that looks like a suitcase is my drawing of, let's say, an epithelial cell that has been, like, sandblasted away. Okay, one side of it is sandblasted away so we can look in. Oh, look, there's its nucleus, and there's its endoplasmic reticulum. And what are these things on the surface of the cell? Well, it's called MHC class 1 molecule, and it's presenting an epitope of 8 to 9 amino acids. All nucleated cells in the body, every cell in your body that has a nucleus is presenting MHC class 1 molecules on their surface, presenting epitopes on MHC class 1. And where did these epitopes come from? They come from proteins that are found in the cytoplasm. At some point, routinely, proteins are channeled through this organelle called a proteasome. They get threaded through, and they get broken up into 8 and 9 amino acid snippets, and they get loaded onto MHC class 1 molecules in their final stages of being transported to the membrane. And who are they presenting these MHC class 1 molecules to? They're presenting them to killer T cells by way of the T cell receptor. Now, although most of the epitopes that are presented on these MHC class 1 molecules are derived from your own proteins, host proteins, any killer T cell that could have recognized a host protein in conjunction with the MHC1 molecule has been eliminated early in development. Early in development, if there's recognition, that killer T cell has been targeted for apoptosis and dies. And this is true of B cells too. So if they have an antibody in their surface that can recognize a self protein, they are eliminated. And this is called clonal deletion. So what's left in our blood are only killer T cells that can recognize foreign epitopes in conjunction with the MHC class 1 molecule. And so if this cell is infected, and it is because I drew in these chlamydia, and if some of these proteins are chlamydia proteins and they're being presented on these MHC class 1 molecules, and the right killer T cell with the receptor that comes by and recognizes it, if recognition occurs, two things happen. Okay, here's the killer T cell. Here's the MHC1 with a chlamydial epitope or a pathogenic epitope, foreign epitope sitting right there. The killer T cell says, oh my God, we have a cell. It's infected. Maybe there's other cells that are infected. I've got to make more of me. And it clonally expands to make more of itself with the exact same T cell receptor that's going to recognize this epitope. It also punches a hole in the cell using perforin. It secretes this thing called perforin, punches a hole in the cell, and if that's not good enough, it also secretes something called granzyme B, which causes this cell to undergo apoptosis. So it like double kills it, okay? And here's like another picture of it. So here's the virus. The proteins are loaded onto MHC class 1 molecules. The killer T cell recognizes it by way of its T cell receptor, and its accessory protein is CD8. Here's the infected cell. Here's the killer T cell. There's the CD8. This is perforin, which is going to puncture a hole in the infected cell. It figures it's better kill this cell now and save the rest of the body. It decides to sacrifice the infected cell. And here's granzyme that causes apoptosis. And here, this cell then ends up looking like this, with holes punched in it, cytoplasm streaming away, and starts to undergo apoptosis. And it makes more of itself. So you end up with an army of memory killer T cells that are going to recognize this exact pathogenic epitope. Here's a killer T cell. Here's an infected cell. And here's a movie. Okay. Remember I said Terminator, right? Okay, there's the T cell. There's the cytoplasm streaming away. And it just keeps going. It doesn't stop. It just keeps going, punching away. Wasn't that awesome? Let's do it again. Okay, that's it. It is so cool. Yep. Okay, and they're on our side, you know. This is the army we have going in our blood. It's just awesome. It's just awesome. Okay. Okay. So, this is the T cell receptor. This is found in both helper T cells and killer T cells. Notice it has a variable region. Early in its development, the T cell precursor actually has both CD4 and CD8, and it's immature at this point. It doesn't know what it is yet. It has both. And then as it develops, it has only one left. So if it remains with the CD4, it is a helper T cell. If it has a CD8 in its final differentiated state, it is a killer T cell. And it's the accessory protein that's it. That's what causes it. And so if we look up close and personal at a MHC receptor, this could be MHC1 or MHC2. This accessory protein could be CD4, CD8. And so if it's MHC1, the accessory protein is CD8. If it's MHC2, the accessory protein that fits MHC class 2 would be CD4. Okay, so now I'm hoping that this will become a little bit more clear for you. So the innate response had lysozyme, the mucociliary ladder, skin and complement, and macrophages and mast cells. It doesn't last very long, and it's really not completely effective in, you know, it wouldn't really work that alone. We need the acquired and adaptive response, which takes a couple of weeks the first time. And so the humoral response and the cell-mediated or cellular or cell-based response. The humoral response has the macrophage that first engulfs the antigen, and the B cell that recognizes the antigen through its specific tethered on its surface antibodies. Both of them engulf it, break it down, and present to the helper T cell. The cell-based response involves killer T cells. So inside the macrophage and the B cell, a lysosome comes over, fuses with the endosome, breaks it into epitopes, which get loaded on MHC class 2 molecules. Inside every nucleated cell in our body, we have a proteasome that's breaking anything that's found in the cytoplasm onto epitopes. And if the cell is infected, those are going to get broken into epitopes and loaded on MHC1 molecule to be hunted down by killer T cells. This is recognized by a T cell receptor with an accessory protein CD4. This one's recognized by a T cell receptor with an accessory protein that's CD8. See, it's not so hard, right? It seems a little bit wordy, but conceptually, it's so the T cell causes the B cell to clonally expand. Some of them become plasma cells, which secrete antibodies. Some of them become long-lived memory B cells. The killer T cell, recognizing an infected cell, will secrete perforin to punch holes in it, granzyme B to kill it through apoptosis, and it also creates lines of memory killer T cells, such that the next time we see the same pathogen, if any, we're ready. Okay, so now, if we didn't have the mechanism to make antibodies or T cell receptors, what if we only had the innate response? And there are people who don't have the acquired or adaptive response. These are other terms I've used. And they're called the bubble boy. Have you heard of the bubble boy? They have to live inside a bubble, basically a plastic shell that's completely sterile. They either don't have B or T cells, or they don't have any antibody or T cell variation. And so the innate response is not quite good enough. And so, on the other hand, sometimes you can have an overactive immune response. For instance, and you could have killer T cells or even antibodies that start to recognize host proteins, and this happens. And the end result of this is autoimmune disease. So here's an example of an autoimmune disease that's caused by killer T cells that have now started to recognize beta cells in the pancreas as being infected, and they kill them. And the beta cells in the pancreas are cells that respond to levels of glucose in your blood. So you have like a candy bar, you eat a meal, there's high levels of glucose in your blood. The beta cells secrete insulin, so that your entire body, the cells in your body, your lung, will make glucose receptors to take that glucose out of the blood and utilize it. So if you don't have beta cells, because they've been killed by the killer T cells, you don't make insulin and you get diabetes. What other autoimmune diseases? There's lupus is an autoimmune disease. Sometimes you can have antibodies that recognize the myelin sheath, the cells that make up the myelin sheath, and then those cells are destroyed. And that results in multiple sclerosis. So these are autoimmune diseases when the immune system goes wild or goes bad. Okay, so I've just sort of built up the immune system as being really great and wonderful, but some of you might have questions and some of you are thinking, well, you know, gee, I've had the flu twice. My roommate's had strep throat a couple of times, you know. What gives? What's with this secondary response, this acquired response? Well, some pathogens, it's an ongoing war, have developed strategies to overcome our immune system. And that's why we use antibiotics to kill them sometimes. Okay, and they're nasty, and they, you know, they grow fast, and they mutate, and they can develop ways of getting around our immune system. For instance, this is a picture of Bacillus anthracis. It has developed this enormous polysaccharide capsule that absolutely prevents it from being phagocytosed by macrophages. Without the capsule, it's absolutely harmless. It absolutely requires the capsule to cause disease, as well as a toxin. That's the only thing it needs, a toxin that's on a plasmid and a capsule. Or let's say we develop antibodies to Neisseria gonorrhea, or we develop antibodies to malaria. What they do, these pathogens, some of them very clever ones, is they say, okay, antibodies are recognizing things on my surface. I know, I'll just change my surface. And they'll change their surface. They'll put up a different protein for phase variation, or they'll mutate and the antibodies are so specific that they cannot recognize this mutated protein, and it's like we're getting it again for the first time. And this actually happens with cholera. So in places where it's endemic, people get it once, they develop long-term resistance, and then every 20 to 40 years, suddenly adults start getting cholera again. And actually, I'm not even sure it happens that frequently. So maybe the last one happened in the late 90s, 1990s, where it just started wiping out adults, you know, and so whole clinics had to be developed in town squares for oral rehydration. And what had happened was the bacterium, the Vibrio cholerae bacterium, changed one sugar residue on its surface. Just one little sugar changed. Fucose turned into a mannose, right? And that was it, because that's what the antibody recognized. So that's and so now new antibodies have to be made to that one, right? So people will get it twice. There are some bacteria that make proteases that are designed to cut our antibodies in half. So horrible. So they just go in there and they secrete these proteases, and the antibodies are just like degraded. Let's see, some pathogens can survive phagocytosis. They send out little messages that prevent the lysosome from coming over, and they live in the phagosome. And, I'm going to be leaving you on a sad note, huh? But do we have any questions? Do we have any questions? No? Perfectly clear? Okay, here you go.